Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Philip Andre, Vice President, Field Marketing North America for Obather Technologies. Philip, thanks for joining me again today.
Good afternoon, Karen. It's always a pleasure.
Always nice to catch up with you. And this conversation is to explore a couple of the topics that we addressed in the most recent issue of the Digital Identity Tracker. And we uncovered some interesting trends and insights. And let's start with the cover story, which was an interview I did with a board member at FIDO, an organization you know very, very well, the Fast Identity Online Alliance. Its whole premise, obviously, is to get rid of passwords. And that's a worthy cause and certainly something I think many people would advocate. But let's start with maybe an obvious question. Is it impossible to secure a password?
It is always possible to secure a password as long as you use a combination of numbers and letters and symbols, and preferably something that's longer than 8 characters in length. The challenge for the human brain is to remember that value, and more importantly, to make sure that every one of your passwords is different across the myriad of websites and services that you access. So, you know, I was going to go in and count the number of websites I've got passwords in my special file, and I was up to 50 before you called.
Wow. So obviously the challenge is, to your point, making something sophisticated enough that hackers can't guess, or harder for them to actually to try to break through, which is why people tend to use simple passwords across all 50 websites or 500 websites that they actually have passwords for. So that therein lies the problem.
Yeah, and if you remember that lovely movie War Games way back when the boy and his girlfriend went out and tried to find the professor's password and discovered it was the child of his that died. You know, we pick something typically that we can remember. Unfortunately, when we pick something we can remember, it's something somebody can figure out.
So
if there is the will, there is the way.
So that is a good segue to what FIDO is really trying to do, which on the surface sounds very simple. Make the authentication of the consumer's digital identity simple, strong, and scalable. As with things that sound straightforward and simple, they're often the most complicated things to implement, which has to be the case with respect to this topic. So your perspective, though, Philip, as someone who's been in the space for a long time trying to sort it out, why is it so challenging?
Tablets and Samsung phones and LTC phones, and it keeps going on and on and on. And all of those computers and devices and tablets need to be able to communicate with the customer in a friendly way. And then we talk browsers, that thing we use to access the internet. So we have iExplorer and Chrome and Firefox and Safari and who knows what else. All of those things then have to integrate the security capabilities to be able to accept a password, because a password has to be securely transmitted across the internet. And that required that the browser manufacturers all agree to a set of standards. And now as we move into FIDO's like solutions, biometric like solutions, when we think about things like Touch ID and what Samsung has done with the 5S and the 6S, where we've now put a fingerprint sensor, what Docomo has done with facial recognition, the browser has to know how to communicate with that thing. And then the server out there at the other end of the internet has to be able to understand what the browser is doing and prompt the browser to do something. And then the relying party, the businessman, has to be able to tell some IT guy, go off and build that for me. And they got a lot of moving parts that have to be assembled. And that's where FIDO comes in. FIDO comes in and says, we will write a set of standards that people, industry, can go off and develop. We will develop a set of interoperability events where people in from industry can come together and test that all the components work together. And that's always the challenge, is how do you assure interoperability that browsers and servers and people and phones and tablets and computers and, you know, security devices can talk and communicate in a seamless way. And that's always been the challenge. That's what standards are all about. That's what people like W3C work on. That's what the FIDO Alliance worked on. That's what the Liberty Alliance worked on. That's what EMV developed. That's what Global Platform developed, is those mechanisms to allow multiple things to communicate seamlessly.
Well, but it, as you describe it, clearly necessary, and the interoperable piece, you know, essential. But it almost sounds like boiling the ocean. It's so big. Computers, devices, browsers, operating systems, you know, devices that we can't even imagine being connected to the internet, but will be. Where do you start, and where is progress really being observed today?
Okay. Where you start is with getting like-minded people together in a room to begin to thrash out the standard, the specification. And that's what the FIDO Alliance did. It brought together the likes of PayPal and Samsung and IBM and Google and Microsoft and NXP and Infineon and ourselves at Overture and our competitors and Qualcomm and Docomo and NIST from the United States and the British government, to bring technical people together in working groups who work diligently together to thrash through and develop these standards and develop and ultimately publish the specification. So that's step one. Write the specification and make sure that the people who are going to actually implement it are sitting at the table. Next step is make those specifications publicly available so that other people who were not sitting at the table can also develop to that specification, to that standard. And then the third piece of the puzzle is to develop a certification framework where somebody who builds a device can take it to a laboratory, to a body, and ask that body to assure them that their device, their invention, works with all the other inventions in this environment. And it's a lot of work. And when you look at FIDO and you look at the alliance that has been formed, you've got 200 plus parties. When you start looking at the caliber of the organizations and you think about the investment and the number of people that are assembling, in fact, in the first week of October, they're meeting in Chicago, and I'm going to suggest there'll be close to 300 people assembling, wow, not for the purpose of a conference, but to actually sit in work groups and work together face to face, as opposed to the work that they have been doing week after week after week over telephones and through email. So they're finally going to come together, meet, and, you know, have that coffee together to argue about why A versus B. So, you know, and there's lots of standards bodies.
So that's the question. There are lots of standard bodies, and 300 people, wow. You know, getting 300 people to agree on what color the napkin should be is a challenge, much less really working through the very, very important issues that are in front of them. What is realistic in terms of time frames for starting to see some of these standards emerge and people begin to adopt them? Because once that happens, then you get critical mass and you start to get others to follow suit. But getting started is tricky.
Absolutely. So let's take a couple FIDO stories. So the first FIDO story is they published a specification called UAF, Universal Authentication Framework. UAF was immediately adopted by Samsung, PayPal, and Alipay. Samsung being the hardware provider, Alipay and PayPal being the relying party, the party who wanted to take advantage of the solution. Mm-hmm. And they went to market with their solution and pushed it out into their ecosystem. So that was one implementation. There was a second specification called U2F, the Universal Two-Factor Framework. And U2F was adopted by Google and people like Yubico, and you talk to Knock Knock, and Knock Knock is in our identity tracker as the party. They came together and they developed, in the context of Google's services, a mechanism to allow their customer to sell hardware, to authenticate people who wanted to access Gmail, who wanted to access Google Plus, who wanted to access other services. If we move outside of FIDO, for example, and we think about Apple and we think about Touch ID, when I look at Touch ID and I look at FIDO, I see a resemblance. And one could think that maybe Apple copied what FIDO was trying to do, but you can't sit there and go, yes, they did or no, they didn't, because there's patents and all kinds of other interesting stuff. But if I look at it from a functional perspective, Touch ID allows an application developer to develop the ability to use the fingerprint pressed onto the Touch ID to authenticate to the application and therefore to the server. If I then move to a FIDO implementation, you mentioned UFAA in our introduction as somebody who has embraced FIDO. I'm going to use Bank of America as my example, because I just happened to have a Bank of America account and actually did it this past weekend. I read a press release where Bank of America announced that they had enabled FIDO on Android and Apple devices. And I went, wow, I've got a Samsung device. It's a 6S. It's the latest and greatest. I have a Bank of America account. So I ended up registering my thumb and my index finger into my Samsung device. And then I told Bank of America through the app that my fingerprint replaces my password. It took me, probably 7 or 8 taps to register the fingerprint. And then it took me one click and answering 2 or 3 questions to confirm to Bank of America I was who I claimed to be and that this was my fingerprint. And now I'm, happily touching my fingerprint to my phone to wake it up instead of entering a PIN. And I'm happily using my fingerprint to open up my Bank of America applet. And it works.
Does it work the first time all the time?
I ended up having to register 3 different ways that I touch the phone to get it to work well. And that's more to do with the Samsung sensor, that it's kind of thin and oblong versus the Touch ID sensor that's round. It's all about how you position your finger. But once I got used to touching it, and I literally started on Friday night, and I was comfortable doing it every time Tuesday morning.
Interesting. So another interesting segue to another topic, which is really, I think, monopolizing the press on all of the authentication discussions, and that's biometrics. And whether it's your fingerprint, your heartbeat, your smile, your blink, there are a lot of experiments now being put into the market that really leverage biometrics, obviously, because it is very personal. It takes what you own to a totally different dimension. Do you see biometrics as really becoming the de facto way authentication happens?
It's going to be one of the more prevalent ways. I don't know if de facto is the right term. It's probably too early to assume de facto. If I go back to EMV and I go back to what we do at Overture Technologies, EMV thought about biometrics back in the 90s. The problem then is the reader was not personal. So you had this issue of who touched the fingerprint sensor last, whose eyeball was up against the retina scanner last, who was in that body sensing cell last, and that gave you a sense of lack of personal space. Now that we're able to make these very small sensors, and it's my phone with my camera, we can get to match on. So if I look at what we've done with PIV, the government identity card, it uses a concept called match on. So in their particular case, the reader is on the door of the building. and the reader sends the fingerprint, the template of the fingerprint, to the chip card. And in the OT chip card, we match the template of the fingerprint registered to the card to the fingerprint presented to the card. And if they match, it's you. If you think about my Samsung 6S, I registered my fingerprint with my phone in a secure way, something very personal to me. And then Bank of America went and enabled, using my phone and the FIDO standard, the ability of their server to communicate with my device and for their server to know that my fingerprint was at that device at that moment in time. My fingerprint is not in the cloud. Good thing. Mm-hmm. Somebody can't go steal my fingerprint. My device is mine, and maybe my device used Retina. Maybe my device used facial recognition. Maybe my device used a kiss or a voice or some kind of gesture. Maybe I have to swing my device in an elliptic curve of a certain nature, which is one tool, or maybe it's my bracelet that measures my pulse. But the device does the biometric, and I select the one that works for me. The communication between the device and the relying party, the bank, is FIDO. And then the server that the relying party uses to authenticate is based on FIDO. And then all that the bank has to do is know, yes, Philip is holding that device right now. Thank you. Please, Mr. FIDO's protocol, give me something that will identify that device and allow me to know that that device has seen the fingerprint right now. And now register Philip's device with fingerprint, and I'm good. And I think we're there. I mean, the technology exists. One of the FIDO working groups that's just been recently formed, when Docomo joined and Docomo's chairing that particular working group, and you think about Japan and what they've done with technology in the past, is now trying to help the world move forward. It's called a deployment at scale. And that working group is looking at the marketing. It's looking at the technology. It's looking at the risk factors to help industries, enterprises, companies see the value, and then to be able to deploy rapidly because they can take something out of the box, plug it in, and it'll work. So we're at that funny point. It's happening. I'm waiting for payments.com to use my biometric to allow me log on.
Well, just wait. There are a lot of new things coming, so just be patient. But talking about the team that you just talked about with your Bank of America, tell me how you see that scaling, since scalable is a key part. Scalable and interoperable are key tenets of what FIDO is trying to do. So tell me how you view that, checking those two boxes.
Okay, so as long as the device manufacturers, so Samsung, LTC, Panasonic, Lenovo, IBM, et cetera, embrace FIDO, which they are, they're sitting around the table, they are building product to that specification. As long as relying parties recognize the simplicity, because frankly it is, once you implement it, it's simple to use. Because what happens is I buy my device, I buy my phone, I buy my Bob, I buy whatever it is I want to buy, me the citizen, me the consumer. And then I register that thing with the relying party. It has no identity that links it to me. I have to say, this thing that is giving you a unique representation is associated with me. I go to the next party, my thing gives the next party another unique identifier, and they link that to me, so that there's no big brother in the mechanism. There's simply me, my device, and you, the relying party, registering something to me. and then knowing it's present. So, you know, at scale, the vendors are building product. We are building product. Our competition is building product. We're all looking to see this. I mean, people like Knock Knock, who's part of our identity tracker, has built product, is a founder. People like PayPal are deploying it as a solution. USAA has deployed it as a solution. Bank of America is deploying it as a solution. ING is at the table. American Express, Discover, MasterCard, Visa are at the table trying to figure out how to use it for various applications, for various use cases. And we're building it in such a way that we can deal with high risk, i.e. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. How do we deal with high risk, government top security type stuff? And how do we deal with low risk, Facebook, Google, Instagram, et cetera, type stuff?
So interesting. That's how it gets scale and becomes interoperable as these new devices are manufactured, as these new digital commerce applications are architected. They're all architected to the standard, and it just kind of propagates.
Go back to your browser. You know, your browser, if you remember the ones we had back in 94, they were pretty, you know, the graphics, it didn't know how to play a video and it didn't know how to do audio or play music. They have evolved, and the browser manufacturers work together to make sure that they evolve together, because ultimately Safari versus iExplorer have to talk to the same bank. So these things evolve, you know, cameras evolve, microphones evolve, FIDO devices evolve.
So a final question. I know that Obisar is really, you know, very involved in so many dimensions of this conversation, but I always like to get the latest and greatest from you on the kinds of things that you're seeing and talking about to the various stakeholders in payments. What's been the topic of conversation the last couple of weeks that you've been out and about talking to people about the age-old problem of authenticating with reliability the consumer's identity?
Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example. We were up at the University of Pittsburgh a couple weeks ago, and there were 29 universities in that room, along with PNC, our banking partner. That conversation was, how do we link payments, a PNC bank account, to campus identity? And we were talking about using contactless smart card-based solutions so that they could secure access to the library, to the dormitory, and they would also have EMV. So that was one very interesting conversation where we were talking about the convergence of identity and payment. We had another conversation that's a little bit older, where we've been talking to several states about looking at first responder for emergency response situation, where they wanted to take the PIV application as the first responder identity and a prepaid payment application and put them together so that a first responder going into an oil field after a hurricane or a tornado or some other natural disaster would have money to buy food and have identity to be allowed in while everybody else was being evacuated from the area. So that was another piece of the puzzle. The other thing we spent a lot of time on is debit, and this whole issue of signature debit, PIN debit, and the migration of EMV into the U.S. market. You know, we've known how to do the card for a very long time. We are now beginning to see the merchants finally figure out how to deploy the software. We've heard from people like Walmart that the fear that EMV was going to be too long is a question of tuning. and John Dresney of Walmart at an EMF conference last week told the audience that he's got the incremental cost of EMV in time down to 0.2 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah.
So progress is being made.
Absolutely. What next? We're talking about putting debit and credit on the same card. It's a little early to do that because you need the terminals to be in place to get there, but people are talking about it. We're talking about the value of offline authentication so that the merchant is able to know it's a good card, even though they're not necessarily able to authorize the transaction in real time, so that they can accept a degree of risk without having to take on the counterfeit risk. So those kind of conversations are taking place. You and I have talked about Medicare, Medicaid. That is an ongoing conversation. We are still pushing in Washington and at state level to get people to understand that we need to secure that environment and that there are tools and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Let's use what is already available. The same device that a doctor receives payment from can be the same device that the doctor recognizes their customer and gets the insurance information from. So those kind of conversations are going on.
Probably an active, I thought the conversation around EMV, the intersection of EMV as the standard and the need to authenticate consumer, I think has created a real opportunity for innovation on so many different levels, bringing payment together with identity in ways that maybe we've never felt we've had the ability to do. But now lots of incentives and lots of capabilities to leverage in order to make it possible.
Absolutely. And with the kind of news that we're getting from, certain national terrorists who keep hacking our environment, the need for an heightened security in the internet space is becoming more and more evident. And I think the consumer, all of us are becoming more real. I mean, the idea that fingerprints were stolen recently scares me. I want my fingerprint in the device that I carry, not up in the cloud that somebody can hack.
Well, I was going to ask you about, what happens when someone steals your fingerprint, which of course used to be a hypothetical, but as we've discovered from the government, OPM hacking is actually reality, and there are lots more of them that were stolen. I think almost 6 million fingerprints. So that's real. And, it's like stealing your social security number. You've got one fingerprint that's very unique to an individual. It's a little scary.
Yeah, and this is where we at OT are firmly of the belief that things like this should be held in the card, in the phone that is carried by the consumer. The idea of putting everything that is me in the cloud harks back to George Orwell. Big Brother will watch if you give him the right to watch. And I think we, the consumer, have to take back the ownership of our identity and insist that it be secured in something that we hold dear to our heart, be it a phone or be it a card or a bracelet, something that's ours, not something that sits in your cloud that we have to trust you to protect.
Well, on that note, Philip, it's always a pleasure to speak with you and to get your perspective on obviously what is a very critical and very important issue on so many levels to everyone in the payments ecosystem, especially the consumer, as you just pointed out. Thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And I did too, as always. Thank you, Karen.